Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And it's all about full compliance with the Constitution. I had a good talk with Jerry Wistrand last night regarding his campaign, and he's been getting some support, but not any support from anybody from this show, and so it kind of is disheartening that not even $5 or anything like that. So I understand it's tough. I understand it's tight. I can tell you folks that the price of liberty, many people throughout the annals of history have laid down their lives for it. And I know $5 can seem like that big difference, but I can tell you that if everybody listens to this show sent $5 to Jerry Wistrand, that would be a huge impact. I look at how many people that actually stream this show and listen live, and I'm knowing, and I can tell you, it's a lot more than, would be more than enough to give him the funding he would need to have a successful campaign. Just, you know, if everybody did it once, that would be, you know, overwhelming. And I get it. We are making individual choices, so I will stop working on my grandpa skills and stop trying to, you know, play the guilt trip here. Bottom line is our liberty is going to cost something, and we need champions. And there's nobody better to probably kick this off, and no state probably better to kick this off than with Jerry Wistrand. So anyhow, it would be nice to hear, because he's about a week or a couple of weeks away from the primary, and getting some gas in his tank would be a little bit overwhelming for him. But bottom line, we need to start doing some things, and some of these things may not be that big to you, even though it may only be $5, even $2. Anything and everything helps, and it all counts. But let me diverge. You've heard here long, 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 long time ago about Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And it was long before it even became chatter in Congress that they might try to use Section 3 of the 14th Amendment against President Trump. That was just because they're a bunch of fools and they are illiterate and they don't understand it. There's been a lot of fundamental constitutional premises that you've heard from here. And one of the things that I think is a fundamental premise that we've kind of covered, and it just kind of hit me this past weekend after, you know, kind of digesting the 4th of July and our rights and so forth. I can't highlight enough how I'm just absolutely amazed on a couple of things. One is our responsibility in supporting the Constitution as citizens of this nation, this legal, moral responsibility every citizen has. And the fact that everybody's looking around at citizens of the United States that are out there calling for, you know, an elimination of our current government and calling for communism and just straight into implementing communism as if they can do that. And they can't do that. And yet our court system has been a huge advocate in moving us down that path. As a matter of fact, many things that you've heard on this show, I've not yet heard in any ripples coming back yet. One of the things that you've heard a few years ago was we proved that the court has no authority to interpret the law. They have no authority to create law. They have no authority to redefine the Constitution. And yet that's exactly what they're doing. And they've been pushing us off the precipice of our demise, you know, gradually and gradually. I mean, we're clinging by our nails here. That's just one of the things. But over the past week, this concept, and I want you to understand this, we the people institute our government. We have this inalienable right to institute, alter, change our government. And if your county government is sitting on its hands, becoming the lapdog for the lobbyists, for the state, and for the federal government waging tyranny upon you, then it's time for you to get organized, take your county, parish, or borough back, and literally start preparing yourself and getting people in office to create your Constitutional Compliance Committee, Assembly, whatever you want to call it, and start moving towards implementing, seizing full control over your government by creating a constitution for that local county, parish, or borough. By doing that, that becomes your government now, and they are answerable to you. And that's how we start going across the state by doing this in every state. This wouldn't take long, folks. As soon as people start realizing, are you kidding me? That's our government. We can do this? And the education factors and all of those things would be involved using petitions, using these constitutional compliance committees, so forth and so on. It all falls into place. It's like the gears will start meshing, and before you know it, we're in overdrive heading towards a full reclamation of our government. But it requires you to do it. I'm not going to be here forever. As a matter of fact, my days are numbered. Time is the same for all. It is finite. You only have so much time. And I'm not going to be here forever. So what are you going to do if all of a sudden I'm not here? Well, you'll find somebody else to listen to that makes you feel better. Hopefully that's not the case. Hopefully the case is that you'll start leading. Because if you know the truth, you are a leader. All you have to do is assert the truth, because that is the fundamental principle of leadership. A true leader basically is able to articulate a core principle, a true core principle that all people can associate with and stand up and say, we need to do this. This is the right thing to do, and that's exactly how we do it. So there you go, folks. My little monologue is kind of done, and we're in the throes of the Virginia debates. And at this point in time, we were just getting ready to dive into what I considered some of the hottest stuff. We just did preferential treatment with George Nicholas. And what we are going to cover right now, and welcome back, Sean, by the way. I'm sorry for just leaning forward here.
Thank you, sir. Good to be here.
Yeah, and it's great to have you. What we're going to do is, and I want you to kind of take your time reading this, because this is about treaties and how Congress cannot actually just go out and, you know, set up and, you know, perform or ratify treaties and so forth. And so, folks, what you need to do is you really need to read this entire portion that comes from George Nicholas. In other words, as you're looking at the document and as it starts, George Nicholas's oration starts on page 127. You need to read this whole thing. And, you know, he kind of starts it off with, although we have sat 8 days, so little has been done that we have hardly begun to discuss the question regularly. The rule of the House to proceed clause by clause has been violated. Remember, I said this in the beginning when we started covering the Virginia debates, how this kept on coming up. I didn't even highlight this, but this right here in the very first paragraph, that it's been violated. Instead of doing this, gentlemen alarm us by declamations without reason or argument, by bold assertions. Remember, I told you, this is what the anti-federalists are doing. They're just getting up and saying, you know, we're all going to die. It's fire without fire. They're getting away with causing alarm without any substantial proof or any supporting evidence, documentation, or anything else. And so you have to understand that even though these men back in those days were civil, there were some constraints. And one of those constraints was what we called the duel. And so it was very, men were very slow in challenging somebody and challenging their integrity and their honor. So they were kind of, you know, very gentlemanly, calling the other gentleman the honorable gentleman and so forth. But bottom line, you really should read everything that George Nicholas, James Madison, I'd read everything that these men wrote and or stated that was documented. But at this point, let's go ahead and just dive into the treaties, this little subsection of the treaties. Go ahead.
Under the Confederation, Congress cannot make a treaty without the consent of 9 states. Congress, by the proposed plan, cannot make a treaty without the consent of 2/3 of the senators present and of the president. 2/3 will amount to 9 states. If the senators from all the states be present, can it be candidly and fairly supposed that they will not all or nearly all be present when so important a subject as a treaty is to be agitated? The consent of the president is a very great security. He is elected by the people at large. He will not have the local interests which a member of the Congress may have. If he deviates from his duty, he is responsible to his constituents. He will be degraded and will bring on his head the accusation of the representatives of the people, an accusation which has ever been and always will be very formidable. He will be absolutely disqualified to hold any place of profit, honor, or trust, and liable to further punishment if he has committed such high crimes as are punishable at common law.
Okay, so
wish that was true still.
You know, it still is true. It's just that we're not abiding by it.
It's not operational.
There we go. We have to demand the rule of law. Our Constitution dictates what the law is, and we have to abide by it, period. So now he's going to dive into direct taxes. And by the way, he's going to comment more on treaties later, like June 19th, something like that. And we'll get into that. But gradually, we want to kind of go through these things. So now let's cover the direct taxes. Go ahead.
Another argument made use of is that ours is the largest state and must pay in proportion to the other states. How does that appear? The proportion of taxes are fixed by the number of inhabitants and not regulated by the extent of territory or fertility of soil. If we be wealthier in proportion than other states, it will fall lighter upon us than upon poorer states. They must fix the taxes so that the poorest states can pay, and Virginia being richer will bear it easier. The honorable gentleman says that the first collections are to go to Congress, and that state legislatures must bear all deficiencies. How does this appear? Does he prove it? Nothing of it appears in the plan itself. The Congress and the state legislatures have concurrent jurisdictions in laying and collecting taxes. There is no rule that shows that Congress shall have the first collections. Each is independent of the other. Another argument against this disingenuous construction is drawn from that clause which regulates representation, which is conclusive from the words themselves. Quote, representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union, according to their respective numbers, end quote. Each state will know from its population its proportion of any general tax. As it was justly observed by the gentleman over the way, Mr. Randolph, they cannot possibly exceed that proportion. They are limited and restrained expressly to it. The state legislatures have no check of this kind. Their power is uncontrolled. This excludes the danger of interference. Each collects its own taxes and bears its own deficiencies. And officers are accountable to each government for the different collections.
You know, in case in point, when, let's just say, the assessment of taxes goes out, and it happens to be, you know, July timeframe when they finally make those assessments because Congress, the government used to, back in these days, would be instituted in March timeframe, because that's when the president was inaugurated. That's when everybody had taken their oath to start the new sessions. And so what would happen is they would kind of meet and go, okay, we're starting a new session. We need to determine if we need taxes or what. You know, what are we going to do? Our direct taxes, we're going to levy any. So when they levy them, let's just say they have them ready and they promulgate, disseminate out to the states in July, the taxes. Now, the states receive these taxes, and let's just say the state of Georgia gets hit by a hurricane like Katrina and just, you know, devastates everything. And the federal government's down there, and they're trying to collect. You think they're going to be able to collect? No. And as a matter of fact, this is how I see it. Because back in those days, there may have been, you know, either had something like that happened, there may have been some compassion in the, you know, the bowels of the other states saying, hey, you know, we'll carry their load because what they've just been devastated, because they were pretty compassionate back in those days, very compassionate. And or the government would have said, okay, you know what, we will do without yours, or we'll collect it later. It's not like the way they were portraying this, that this federal government would automatically put their heel on the throat of that state and not be empathetic and understanding, because why would anybody think that that would serve them, considering that these people are coming from the states themselves? Congress is being manned by people coming from the states. These aren't people we're importing from Germany without, you know, any compassion, without any empathy, you know, just stoic and hard-hearted. No. We're talking about people that understand they're coming from these states. And this goes back to the hyperbole that he mentioned in the previous section, where, you know, these anti-federalists were getting away with creating these paradigms that they couldn't support. I mean, you know, a lot of people, this goes back to fear-mongering. This goes back to, you know, just using demagoguery to try to obtain your outcome. In other words, it almost sounds like the leftist, doesn't it?
What? Yes, sir. It sure does.
The means, you know, the ends. What is it? Help me out here.
Justify the ends.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you. I forgot that old saying. The means justify the ends. Thank you. And so it's okay to lie as long as we killed the Constitution. And it's, folks, do a check here. Do a gut check. We look at these men as good and honorable men, but I am telling you that these good, honorable men were susceptible, and I believe they were overcome by the spirit of contention, which means that I think that they were possessed by Satan to drive these types of points because of their lust for mammon, their lust for the power and the money that they were trying to protect in the states. As we look, and it just bothers me to hear people say that the anti-federalists were right. No, prove it to me. Prove to me how they were right in the way they were making their arguments. It was strictly demagoguery. Yeah, every time they made something that may have been a coherent argument, within that coherent argument was a process that was a direct violation of the Constitution, like not supporting the militia. Therefore, they were lying through their teeth. They were being intentionally deceitful. What do you want to, however you want to call it, don't tell me the anti-federalists were right. What ended up happening was the Federalists became corrupted by Hamilton. The Federalists, or I should say post the Constitution, and all these people that supported the Constitution, by the way, not all people that were supported the Constitution went into office. As a matter of fact, if you go through who went into office from Virginia, They were anti-federalists that went into the Senate. They were anti-federalists that went into as much as possible that Patrick Henry could invoke and or influence. Anti-federalists went from that state into the public offices of the Senate and Congress. I hope you understand this. Which means that these men were probably more likely, more culpable of becoming corrupt because they were already a part of the trusted system. Patrick Henry was basically sending these men to kill the Constitution. He wanted to have another convention. And he had no idea how corrupt these men were, because if you look at what happened when Madison became the champion of the Bill of Rights, he exposed their underbelly. Because all of the anti-federalists who were demanding in the ratification debates, we got to have a Bill of Rights. We got to have it. And yet, as soon as Madison started arguing for it in the House, they said, hey, hold on. This is a brand new government. Let's kick the tires. Let's take it around the block. It's too early to start looking at amendments. This is a good thing. Where just a year or so before, they were saying, this is the worst thing ever. We need a Bill of Rights. This only goes to show that even though these men were honorable in everybody's, you know, they were godly men. They were going to church. How honorable were they really? Or how susceptible were they? There were some really good, honorable men. And I'm going to tell you, many of the framers, Eldridge Gerry, you know, Eldridge Gerry made some mistakes. George Mason made some mistakes. As a matter of fact, George Mason post the Constitution. So this is one of the things I remember reading about. After the ratification debates, after these debates in Virginia, and after the Constitution being ratified by Virginia, George Mason grabbed his underlings, those people that were following him or sycophants, whatever, and he had a meeting, and Patrick Henry was, you know, kind of going by as they were getting ready to meet. And Mason called him out and said, hey, we're going to have a meeting so that we can start talking about our plan in getting a Bill of Rights. And Patrick Henry said, nah, that's okay. You know, the Constitution's ratified. And he smiled and said, I'm going to support it the way it is. You know, I'm going to support it because, you know, I kind of, because they all basically said, hey, if it passes, we'll support it. And yet Mason started going down this path of, you know, trying to at least invoke the Bill of Rights. It wasn't like he was trying to undermine it, but Patrick Henry actually did. Patrick Henry got the state legislature to call for and submit a petition to call for a convention, an Article 5 convention. So, so just to show you how, you know, the spirit of these men and how they were, I'll just say, possessed in trying to do anything and everything they could for the purposes or whatever the reasons were. And I have a hard time finding honorable as that underlying or that foundational reason. It wasn't because it's honorable. I think George Mason, he truly believed in a Bill of Rights. He didn't see that an enumerated Constitution was more than sufficient, and actually, it was perfect. The only reason the Bill of Rights became essential is because of slavery and ultimately the Civil War. Because the Bill of Rights needed to be applied to the states. What they created in those Bill of Rights, what Madison's basically put into the Constitution, that's what needed to be applied at the state level to ensure that all U.S. citizens would have equal protection under the law, that they would be, their rights would be secured. That's the whole point of our government. Again, the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence, what we just went through, was we institute government to secure our rights. Our rights, but not theirs. And that's the point. And so anyway, forgive me for this rat hole. We will be right back after this short promo. So folks, hang in there, stay tuned. We'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so, yeah, look at that, 12 seconds, that's how I missed it. So, anywho, folks, the direct taxes was another way of trying to create these arguments that were just, again, hyperbole, fear-mongering, demagoguery, and so forth. The next issue that he dives into is the General Defense and Welfare Clause. So let's dive into that one. Thank you.
It provides, quote, that Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, end quote. The debts of the Union ought to be paid. Ought not the common defense to be provided for? Is it not necessary to provide for the general welfare? It has been fully proved that this power could not be given to another body. The amounts to be raised are confined to these purposes solely. Will oppressive burden be warranted by this clause? They are not to raise money for any other purpose. It is a power which is drawn from his favorite confederation, the eighth article of which provides, quote, that all charges of war and all other expenses that shall be incurred for the common defense or general welfare and allowed by the United States and Congress assembled shall be defrayed out of a common treasury, which shall be supplied by the several states in proportion to the value of all lands within each state, granted to or surveyed for any person as such land, and the building and improvement thereon shall be estimated according to such mode as the United States in Congress assembled shall from time to time direct and appoint.
Okay, and then somehow, because they simplified it, that they basically said that the Congress had the power to lay taxes, right? As a matter of fact, let me get to the direct verbiage in that preamble. And it says this. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises. So they're going to have the power to lay these types of taxes, to pay the debts, and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But, and they're creating this caveat, but all duties, imposts, excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. Something that wasn't really laid out here. Because in many ways, they felt that and they realized that there was ways of actually creating disadvantages for certain folks in creating taxes or the burden of direct tax on some states, where in other states it wouldn't be so. It wouldn't be so burdensome. So as we look at the language of the Articles of Confederation, there was a lot more there, right, Sean?
Absolutely.
And it actually pointed to, you know, how they were going to do it by the value of lands and everything else. And I believe that had they gone down the enforcement, it would have, instead of going to the state legislature to try to help defray the costs, in other words, to make sure that certain types of people, widows and so forth, didn't lose their homes because they had a burden of taxes. So the point is that this concept that the general common defense and general welfare of the United States had nothing to do with literally providing for feeding the people, had nothing to do with anything other than for the federal government to do those things it needed to do. It was going to be able to lay taxes for those sole purposes, period. And so in the cod fishery bounties, that's Madison basically said the same thing. There's been many different ways that they've spelled this out. But folks, you need to highlight this one part. This part that he says, it is a power which was drawn from his favorite confederation, the eighth article of which provides, quote, and then he reads through that. Okay, so now let's dive into the taxes part.
Quote, the taxes for paying that proportion shall be laid and levied by the authority and direction of the legislature of the several states, within the time agreed upon by the United States in Congress assembled, end quote. Now, sir, by a comparison of this article with the clause in the Constitution, we shall find them to be nearly the same. The common defense and general welfare are the objects expressly mentioned to be provided for in both systems. The power and confederation to secure and provide for those objects was constitutionally unlimited. The requisitions of Congress are binding on the states, though, from the imbecility of their nature, they cannot be enforced. The same power is intended by the Constitution. The only difference between them is that Congress is, by this plan, to impose the taxes on the people, whereas by the Confederation, they are laid by the states. The amount to be raised and the power given to raise it is the same in principle. The mode of raising only is different, and this difference is founded on the necessity of giving the government that energy without which it cannot exist. The power has not been reprobated in the Confederation. It ought not to be blamed in the proposed plan of government.
There you go. So, all right, so now he also dives into this other thing called the necessary, or this is the sweeping clause. So let's go ahead and hit that one now. As you can see, I'm breaking these things up so you can kind of see how in this one oration he's kind of covering all these different things. And folks, I'm going to go back to this. He's doing this, boom, boom, boom. He's throwing the left and then the jab and then, you know, the roundhouse and the uppercut. He's doing this because the anti-federalists are just swarming with all these unfounded charges. And he, as the Federalist, is in the corner, basically knocking them back, literally marching across the ring, pulverizing these guys with facts. Go ahead. Sorry.
No problem, sir. The gentleman has adverted to what he calls the sweeping clause, etc., and represents it as replete with great dangers. This dreaded clause runs in the following words, quote, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof, end quote. The committee will perceive that the Constitution had enumerated all the powers which the general government should have, but did not say how they were to be exercised. It therefore, in this clause, tells how they shall be exercised. Does this give any new power? I say not. Suppose it had been inserted at the end of every power, that they should have power to make laws to carry that power into execution. Would this have increased their powers? If therefore, it could not have increased their powers, it placed at the end of each power. It cannot increase them at the end of all. This clause only enables them to carry into execution the powers given to them, but gives them no additional power.
Okay, so now, again, he starts jabbing with a want of a Bill of Rights, but is objected for the want of a Bill of Rights. And this is one of my favorite parts because I actually use the term metal, because that's what he used for, you know, helping helping explain, or that's the precise adjective that he used to help people realize that the government just can't meddle with anything and everything they want. Go ahead.
But it is objected for want of a Bill of Rights. It is a principle universally agreed upon that all powers not given are retained, where, by the Constitution, the general government has general powers for any purpose, its powers are absolute. Where it has powers with some exception, they are only absolute as to those exceptions. In either case, the people retain what is not conferred on the general government, as it is by their positive grant that it has any of its powers. In England, in all disputes between the king and the people, recurrence is had to the enumerated rights of the people to determine, are the rights in dispute secured? Are they included in the Magna Carta, Bill of Rights, etc.? If not, they are, generally speaking, within the king's prerogative. In disputes between Congress and the people, the reverse of the proposition holds. Is the disputed right enumerated? If not, Congress cannot meddle with it.
If the dispute is not within the enumerated objects, in other words, if Congress is doing something, they're creating a law, like a bank, that is not implied directly as a derivative of the power granted, that Congress will have the power by using charters to create an institution. I mean, had that power been there, then that would have basically opened the door for them to do it. But because they have the good faith and credit of the United States to take on debt, doesn't imply that they have that power. It has to be a derivative of the power delegated or granted. So just because they have the power to tax, because they have the power for the good faith and credit of the United States by going and borrowing money from another nation, does not grant them the power to create a bank or grant them the power to even create an institution. Remember, folks, we've covered this before and we're going to cover it again when we get into the Assumption Act. Madison brought up that during the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, the question was, did they want the federal government to have the power to create a charter like the king so that they could go off and create a state so they could actually create, because that's what the king did. He created colonies by using charters, which means that government was going, that institution, whether it be a government, corporation, bank, whatever, was created by the sovereignty of that government, not by the people, which would have been antithetical to the new paradigm that I've been talking about based on that Declaration of Independence, that we institute our governments, granting government the ability to institute institutions and governments over us and for us is antithetical to the whole point of the Declaration of Independence. We institute them, and they serve us. And when we believe that they're no longer serving us, we have an inalienable right to alter, change, abolish, and institute new, whatever we decide. And here's the beautiful thing. Based on the Constitution, we don't need to institute new. We just have to demand that they get back into form, which is basically altering their perversions back into the proper mode as directed or as designed. So forgive me for there. So let's just dive into the next one, which is actually this is Madison now, and this is on the next day, where we're talking about a militia. Let's go ahead.
I just wanted to make one point, if you don't mind.
No, please, 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 please.
I love the part where he talks about and just explains it very simply. In England, all disputes between the king and the people, recurrence it has had to the enumerated rights of the people.
Uh-huh, yep.
But ours is reversed.
So yes.
The sovereign in England is the king. The sovereign in the United States is the people.
Yes.
And we retain all the rights. In England, the king retained all the rights, and he gave you what he thought, you know, he felt like giving you.
Okay,
here, so we are giving the government the authority to do what they do.
There you go. In okay. England, go ahead. Keep going. Yeah. Keep going.
No, that's it. That's
okay. Just so the only correction I have is we can't lose sight of the fact that when we institute government, we do give them sovereignty over those very few things delegated. That's it.
Correct.
Okay. Correct. That means that all things not delegated to that government are reserved not to just we the people, but to possibly another government that we may have instituted down the river or upriver. You know, when we look upriver, that could be the state, and farther upriver, that could be the county.
Correct.
Okay. There we go, because when you start understanding this...
But it flows from the people
absolutely,
to the government.
Absolutely.
Not the other way around.
This is why Madison summarized this in the Virginia his notes on the Virginia Resolutions of 1800. He summarized it so succinctly. Government's authority comes from the constitutions, and constitutions are derived by the authority and sovereignty of the people. And when you start to get this, folks, now you can start seeing that we don't have just a constitutional republic. We have a hybrid constitutional republic, which means we should have multiple constitutions. Your city shouldn't have a charter. Your city should have a constitution, and the people should actually limit that city to being able to do those things. And if we would have stuck to constitutions, we would have probably stuck to utilizing the militia instead of allowing charters to be created for mercenary forces to be formed. I'm just going through all of these things that I pointed out, and I don't mean to, you know, maybe I'm fire hosing in some respects because I'm covering other things that we covered before. But folks, these things are so powerful. And George Nicholas, like I said, he is probably one of the most underrated spokesmen or statesmen regarding the Constitution. Madison is probably the one of the most that was so profound in leading, because Nicholas, here he was very profound in these debates for Kentucky, and then in Kentucky he had a strong political career. But he never made it to presidency. I would have loved to. I kind of curiously wonder why there was no sign, because I didn't follow him. I don't know when he died or what happened. But you would have thought that maybe Madison would have called him as a Secretary of State. He would have been a much better Secretary of State than James Monroe. And then ultimately could have become the next president instead of James Monroe, and could have actually been, you know, instrumental in making sure that the Public Lands Act would never have moved forward. You got to remember, James Monroe was actually an anti-federalist at this point in time. And so did he change? Did he purely, you know, come unto the Constitution like people should purely come unto Christ? You know, in living all the commandments, living the full paradigm, the full gospel. And I don't think James Monroe did, because James Monroe sat there and watched these things happen. He did some things that were very obvious. You know, he vetoed the Department of Transportation bill, you know, the Cumberland Gap bill, which was like the bonus bill for Madison. But do you see my point? I hope that you personally begin to start appreciating some of these other men. James Iredell is another guy. We haven't hit him yet. And the way that they have intellectually articulated these concepts. I mean, it's great to hit the spiritual side of this that we saw with both Pennsylvania and even more so with Massachusetts. So, I mean, going through the different debates, I think is such a fulfilling and edifying process, so that you really can see from different paradigms this Constitution. But for me, on the intellectual side, these men, they're just, you know, and I'm glad that, you know, we've captured all of this, because the fact that we've captured all of this, folks, gives us the legal basis of resetting our government, reclaiming our government, because everything they're saying is legally binding. All right. Now let's dive down to the Madison's militia statement with the June 11th first comment. Go ahead.
First, then, is it necessary? I must acknowledge that I concur in opinion with those gentlemen who told you that this branch of revenue was essential to the salvation of the Union. It appears to me necessary in order to secure that punctuality which is necessary in revenue matters. Without punctuality, individuals will give it no confidence, without which it cannot get resources. I beg gentlemen to consider the situation of this country. If unhappily the government were to be deprived of this power, let us suppose for a moment that one of those powers which may be unfriendly to us should take advantage of our weakness, which they will be more ready to do when they know the want of this resource in our government. Suppose it should attack us. What forces could we oppose to it? Could we find safety in such forces as we could call out? Could we call forth a sufficient number, either by drafts or any other way, to repel a powerful enemy? The inability of the government to raise and support regular troops would compel us to depend on the militia.
Okay. So what better way than to integrate the militia into that forming of an army? And so, in other words, by making the source a permanent source as an asset, not just for the states, but an asset for the federal government. Had the states actually embraced the militia concept and said, you know what, we're going to use this as our police force, and it's going to be integral to, down to the counties, that the sheriff, and that's exactly what they kind of did. Because when you really look at what was the posse? The posse was a few people that the sheriff trusted, but they weren't getting the money. The federal government started actually spending all the money so that they could create this regular army that they wanted to maintain. They weren't really following the militia as they set up the cavalry to basically go across the West. It became a permanent army. And as in so doing, they were bypassing the state militia and everything else. The state should have held them accountable. Mason died young. He died early, I should say. He died in the 1790s, if I remember correctly, just like Washington. But, you know, Washington was an army man, and so was Mason. But Mason was a huge, huge supporter of the militia, as we're going to find out on June 14th, 16th, and so forth. Anyway, let's go to the next one, this note.
I shall take a view of certain subjects which will lead to some reflections to quiet the mind of those gentlemen who think that the individual governments will be swallowed up by the general government. In order to effect this, it is proper to compare the state governments with the general government with respect to reciprocal dependence and with respect to the means they have of supporting themselves or of encroaching on one another. At the first comparison, we must be struck with these remarkable facts. The general government has not the appointment of a single branch of the individual governments or of any officers within the states to execute their laws. Are not the states integral parts of the general government? Is not the president chosen under the influence of state legislatures? May we not suppose that he will be complacent to those from whom he has his appointment and from whom he must have his reappointment? The senators are appointed altogether by the legislatures. My honorable friend apprehended a coalition between the president, Senate, and House of Representatives against the states. This could be supposed only from a similarity of the component parts. A coalition is not likely to take place because its component parts are heterogeneous in their nature. The House of Representatives is not chosen by the state governments, but under the influence of those who compose the state legislatures. Let us suppose 10 men appointed to carry the government into effect. There is every degree of certainty that they would be indebted for their re-election to the members of the legislature. If they derive their appointment from them, will they not execute their duty to them? Besides this, will not the people, whose predominant interests will ultimately prevail, feel great attachment to the state legislatures? They have the care of all local interests, those familiar domestic subjects, which men have the strongest predilection. The general government, on the contrary, has the preservation of the aggregate interests of the Union, objects which, being less familiar and more remote from men's notice, have a less powerful influence on their minds. Do we not see great and natural attachments arising from local considerations? This will be the case in a much stronger degree in the state governments than in the general government. The people will be attached to their state legislatures from 1,000 causes and into whatever the scale people at large will throw themselves. That scale will preponderate.
Now, see, here's the interesting thing. Madison kind of throws what most people would see as a curveball, because he says here, the House of Representatives is not chosen by the state governments, but under the influence of those who compose the state legislatures. The influence is the setting up of the congressional districts. Clearly, the people vote and choose who they're voting for, but those districts can be gerrymandered. He right here is admitting that the state legislature has their fingers in being able to manipulate the outcome of what those representatives will be. And we see that today, right?
For sure.
Okay. So he didn't want to let everybody think that this was just a pure democracy. No, there was more control done at the state level than most people think. What really happened was the states didn't start getting organized and the federal government didn't start colluding to a level or to a degree to where we really started going sideways as a nation until the parties really started functioning and operating. And then when they started colluding, woo, that's when we really, that's where the term drifting, you know, as a nation came in, because we really were drifting at that point. Because with the Republican Party basically obsoleting the Federalists, then the Federalists converting into the Democrats, and then the Democrats going back and forth between the Whigs, so forth and so on, and we're out of time. But the point is that this, you know, they were colluding and they were kind of, but they weren't drift colluding where they were really working together until the party primaries were instituted between the Democrats and the Republicans in 1856, folks. So we almost went a full century before they really decided to lock arms and grab a hold and take and seize control over who has access to public office. That's when they locked it down. From that point on, it's just been, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.